Thank you for allowing WPR into your day. Be it busy or relaxing, we're designed to fit anywhere, and here comes a part of our Western Wisconsin wardrobe. This is Spectrum West. This week, we have a well-known reporter who's traveling to Eau Claire to deliver a message during a conference named after a predecessor. Ashley Parker, The Washington Post, is here with what it looks like from where she stands. We're just a week away from the 52nd Eau Claire Jazz Festival, so it's about time we let you know all that's going on. Mark Blaski knows, and he's here. Jim Oliver's in the house, and in order of appearance, he will share a conversation with Buffy Mitchell, who's directing Church Basement Ladies for the Barron Spotlighters opening Friday. And he'll fill in all the blanks with what's on stage in Western Wisconsin. So that's all coming up, and in the meantime, sing along. Happy birthday to you. And the U is the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. It's 50 years old this year, and thus the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway is too. By the way, you don't look a day over 39. It's special and includes a couple immaculate waterways that course through northwestern Wisconsin, the St. Croix and the Namekagon. We talked with one of the people throwing the big party, superintendent of the Riverway, Julie Galanska. Hey, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
This is a pretty big deal.
Of the eight original rivers in the 1968 legislation, the St. Croix and Namekagon were the only ones that were included in the national park system. So we are, in effect, America's first wild and scenic river national park.
Good for you. And you've been with them all those years.
No. I've been the superintendent here officially since last September, but I've been at the park for the last 10 years. Yep. My previous position was chief of interpretation and education.
We talked just after you had your step up, and that's great. You had a press conference last week in which state and national office holders and special guests spoke and outlined special ways that you'll be celebrating collaborations between elected officials, community members, young people, and more. For those who are maybe new to the area, what communities are some of them represented and proud to have these rivers pass their towns?
Sure. The Namekagon River, the entire length of it, is included in the riverway. So that passes through a small portion of Bayfield County, through Sawyer County, the town of Hayward, through Washburn County, so Spooner, Wisconsin, and then into Burnett County. And so we pass through Danbury, and just above Danbury is where the Namekagon joins the St. Croix. We protect about 150 miles of the St. Croix River, so from just below Gordon Dam down to near Stillwater, Minnesota, the boom site on the St. Croix River is part of the what we call the federal zone. Beyond that, the last 25 miles to the confluence with the Mississippi at Prescott, Wisconsin, is managed by the Minnesota and Wisconsin DNR. So that's called the state zone of the riverway.
Okay. Has that, the zone that you just described of the two rivers, stayed the same for 50 years, or has it been enlarged as time went on?
Right. In 1968, the protection was from St. Croix Falls, Taylor's Falls, basically Highway 8 north on the St. Croix, and then the entire Namekagon.
Okay.
In 1972, another piece of legislation was passed, an amendment to the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act that added the lower riverway. And it added it at that point into the two zones. Part of it was Park Service, and then part of it was managed by the state.
Okay. Now, the lone business, quote-unquote, for lack of a better term, that was at last week's conference was Xcel Energy, formerly NSP, Northern State Power. They donated 24,000 acres along the riverway to the government. Before we highlight some things that you guys have planned for this big birthday party, there was one comment in your release that spawned a question from me. The line is, "We must remain vigilant to preserve this great national treasure and our clean air and water." Now, that's always felt like a given for me and others. Until now, those in the big chairs in Washington don't have seemingly the same reverence for natural things as maybe previous administrators did. What do you sense from the current people in the Interior Department and EPA. Do you feel secure, or have you stepped up efforts to stay proactively ahead of a possible change of focus?
The story of the Riverway, even before it was designated, is really the story of people coming together to protect it because it was valuable to them, mm-hmm. Both on a local level and a regional level and eventually a national level. And so what we see here, and I think this is one of not only the great stories but also the great lessons for how we move ahead, is how folks can, from communities, from an individual basis, from a corporate partnership basis, from legislators at local, state, and national levels, how working together can really achieve something that has value for the natural environment, which has value for our history and heritage, and which has economic value. The Riverway has an economic contribution of over $30 million every year based on the people who come and use it for recreation, who come to enjoy it from a natural resources perspective, or to learn about the history that happened here.
What you're saying is your fingers are crossed that everybody will continue working together.
I think people really value this place.
Well, it helps for us to live around it, and we feel much more strongly because of that. But sometimes the people who aren't around here get their heads turned in odd ways. So, forgive me for bringing that up, but it's a concern nowadays with a lot of things clean and fresh. Julie Galanska, Superintendent, St. Croix National Scenic Riverway, with us. It's the 50th anniversary this year of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. Okay, Julie, now with everything in mind, let's keep focused on the warm and fuzzy things, like what you have planned for this special year.
We have a few what we call signature events that are things that are kind of going to attract some more people, attract some more attention. One of those is the debut of a new documentary film on the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway called The Wild and Scenic St. Croix. It will have a film premiere on June 6th in St. Paul at the Fitzgerald Theater, but will also be shown on Twin Cities Public Television and Wisconsin Public Television beginning in June. And another really spectacular feature is a new book by nature photographer Craig Blacklock. A lot of people know his work from the Apostle Islands or from the North Shore of Minnesota, Pictured Rocks National Lakeshore. Mm-hmm. And he spent about 18 months out on the St. Croix and Namekagon and in the surrounding watershed and communities taking pictures, probably took thousands of pictures. And his book is just out, hot off the presses. It's called The St. Croix and Namekagon Rivers, The Enduring Gift. And in addition to the book, there will be displays of those photographs in several galleries and other locations. So we have a small selection here at the St. Croix River Visitor Center, which opened for the season last week, and we're open 9 to 5 daily, free of charge. So folks can stop by here, our location in St. Croix Falls, to see some of them. And then a bigger show will be opening at the Mill City Museum in Minneapolis, I guess later this week, starting on April 12th.
And soon I'll be talking about, through some public service announcements, your annual reservations and permits for camping along the river. People who participate in normal annual things like that, first of all, it's a great idea to consider doing that this year, being the 50th year. But if people are involved in some of the things that you do on a regular basis, will they feel the 50 years? Do you have kind of a 50-year feel to most everything you're doing, even the normal things?
We do. We know that the backbone of this park is the visitor experience, and people who come back here, sometimes families who come back here year after year, generation after generation. So whether folks are out there planning their own trip, and we do have several opportunities coming up for trip planning sessions, both here at the Visitor Center and in other locations, we always encourage people to give us a call or stop by, talk to a ranger. When you pick up your map this year, you'll see the 50th anniversary logo. We have retail spaces in both of our visitor centers where you can pick up your 50th anniversary souvenirs and learn a little bit more about the park as well. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole series of special programs that people can sign up for, register for, whether it's paddling or some bike and paddle programs, There'll probably be some hiking programs as well. We have a couple of what we call family nature days planned at several locations later in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other things where people who don't like to necessarily get out on the water can participate through one of our outfitters, say by going on a scenic boat tour. And we've communicated and talked with all of those folks about the importance of the 50th and getting that into the tours they give and the messages that they send out there as well.
How do you and the St. Croix River Association interact?
The St. Croix River Association is our official nonprofit partner here at the Riverway, our friends group. Some people may be more familiar with that term. And they are primary partner on the 50th anniversary. The River Association has really taken the lead on planning a lot of the events and helping us really have a celebratory tone to them. So hand in hand, we're working together with SCRA.
And you have, both of you, good websites.
So one-stop shopping on these websites, St. Croix River Association.org. It's STCROIX, River Association.org.
Okay. Yeah, yours is a little more involved.
Yes. So it's NPS for National Park Service .gov/SACN. And one of the great things that we have on our website is a 50 things you can do to celebrate the 50th anniversary. So folks can check that out and start going down their checklist of all the experiences they want to have this year.
What does SACN stand for?
The way that we get our acronyms in the Park Service has to do with the first letters in the first words of your park name. However, if another park has taken those letters, they have to improvise. So St. Croix, you would normally have S-A-C-R. But there's a different St. Croix that has that acronym. So ours is S-A for Saint, and then C for the Croix, and then N for the National.
I'm glad I asked. I thought I was going to have you say, oh, come on, Al, it stands for... And then I was going to look dumb, but it's a good question. Well, anyway, hey, again, a happy birthday. This is a big year, and it's a big commemoration of what some very wonderful people did years ago, 50 years ago, to be exact. Congratulations. We feel good about having folks like you representing our love of the resources that we enjoy and share. And Julie Galanska, thanks for being with us on WPR.
Thank you so much.
Yet to come on Spectrum West, what it's like to cover the White House in the age of Trump, a 52-year-old jazz festival, and Jim Oliver's Waiting in the Wings. Support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona, collections comprised of art inspired by water from European and American masters, including Picasso, Audubon, and others. More about the museum at mmam.org. Support also comes from Chan Hassen Dinner Theaters, performing Disney's new Broadway musical Newsies, presented by Star Tribune. A high-energy song and dance celebration. More information is available at chanhassendt.com. It's a play that, just like the ladies depicted in it, has been around the block a few times. And who better than Jim Oliver, another experienced trooper, to bring it to us? Church Basement Ladies is a musical comedy with book by Jim Stowell and Jessica Zulke, and music and lyrics by Drew Jansen. The musical is inspired by the humorous book Growing Up Lutheran by Janet Letness Martin and Suzanne Nelson. Their lives and writings have inspired five additional Church Basement Ladies musicals. The Barron Spotlighter's production of Church Basement Ladies will run Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and the following Friday through Sunday at the Barron Area Community Center. Joining us by telephone to talk about Church Basement Ladies is the director, Buffy Mitchell. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jim. First thing I have to ask you, tell us about your experience in church basements.
My husband and I both grew up in the church. My family was Methodist, and my mother spent much time in the basement with other ladies preparing for funerals and weddings and all different kinds of feasts that happened during the year during church. With Stephen, his mother had a very large family, and they were traveling ministers, but they were always involved in serving and helping in any church that they were involved in.
Well, why don't you tell us about the play?
Church Basement Ladies takes a year of 1964 in the lives of four women who are the heart of East Cornucopia Lutheran Church of the Prairie in Cornucopia, Minnesota. The year will include things such as a funeral and a wedding, the annual Lutefisk dinner, and Easter, which is celebrated in a very unique way. So it has a lot of really fun but meaningful moments.
I got to ask you this. I grew up Methodist as well, but we never had Lutefisk suppers like the Lutherans do. Did you ever have experience?
Absolutely not. I'm kind of grateful for that.
Yes, that was, I thought, one advantage that we Methodists had. We didn't have to worry about that, although I did get invited occasionally to a Lutefisk supper.
Did you partake?
Well, I'll tell you what. I spent most of my time eating the mashed potatoes and hamburger gravy. That was delicious.
There you go. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'll talk a little bit about the cast members. How big is the cast, by the way?
So the cast is five, and we are blessed with a tremendous cast. Deanna Westfall plays Karen, who is the mom of Signe, and she's in her 40s. She's a very fashion-forward mom. Her daughter, Signe, played by Lindsay Schnacki, is in her late teens, early 20s. She is a student at the University of Minnesota, and others feel that she's being corrupted in the big city. Shannon Paul plays Mavis, and Mavis is in her late 50s, and Mavis is the life of the church basement lady. She is what you would call a hoot. She's just a ton of fun. And then Beth Halverson plays Vivian, and Vivian is our oldest church basement lady. She's been there the longest, the absolute boss of the church basement. The Pastor Gunderson is played by David Mitchell, and he really has been enjoying hanging out with these four ladies. He's newly married, as he is widowed, and he has a much younger wife, and so there's a lot of discussion about his new wife in the church basement.
Now, it is a musical, so talk a little bit about the music in the show. I don't remember any hits coming out of Church Basement Ladies.
Well, there was no pop hits coming out of it. However, there's excellent harmonic music, a lot of solos with songs such as Closer to Heaven, Tail Food Polka, Get Down to Business, and The Cities. All of our ladies and David are phenomenal singers. The tight harmonies are great, and the cast is bonded in such a tremendous way. It really adds to the authenticity of the friendship of the characters.
She is Buffy Mitchell, who is director of the Baron Spotlighter's production of Church Basement Ladies. Let's talk about the technical crew then. You have a musical director and choreography and so forth.
We do. So our musical director is Tony Matuszewski. He is the music director at the Rice Lake Middle School. He has donated a lot of his time to help and has really had a huge part in making this successful. We got an email from him yesterday letting us know that they had their last vocal rehearsal and that he's extremely excited that the cast is absolutely ready for this.
Do you have a choreographer, too? Is there a choreography?
Our choreographer is actually all of the ladies. We actually just sit and talk through it and decide what works for us. Some of us can dance. Most of us can't. And so we have made it that everyone can participate and feel comfortable doing so.
Do you have set builders and lighting and sound and that
sort
of thing?
Yes. So my husband designed the set, but Derek Rogers built the set, and he did a phenomenal job. It's a simple set because Lutherans believe in simplicity. We ended up purchasing a 1960s refrigerator. I bought it for my husband for Father's Day, but it really is kind of the crown jewel of the set.
You have to do some, improvisation in terms of having a fully equipped church basement cook supper.
We do and we don't, because we have been incredibly blessed. The Pioneer Village Museum in Cameron loaned us much of their 1960s 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s kitchen. Yeah. And then Restore of Marin County graciously loaned us a couple of pieces, and they had a 1960s refrigerator that I ended up purchasing for my husband.
Mm-hmm. Well, you are the director, and I know you've been around the theater for quite a long time, at least about as long as I've been around here. Talk about your experience with theater in directing and in other things.
Absolutely. So Stephen and I co-direct this. We're very fortunate. It's a family event for us. So Stephen and I, if we're going to do a show, we do it together so that we don't miss time with each other. So we've had the privilege of working in community theater for both Northern Star Theater and Barron Spotlighters for the past 16 years. Our entire family have participated on stage. A lot of families have sports interests. Our family did theater. Our last production was Diary of Anne Frank at the Barron Spotlighters. Thereafter, we took a two-year hiatus and are thrilled to be back at Barron Spotlighters with Church Basement Ladies. Stephen also has acted in many community theater productions. His favorite role ever was that of Bill Sykes in Oliver.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned that you've been involved with Northern Star Theater, and I know that there's a big change going on up there. How is that going?
It is going great. So they formally purchased the facility. They did do a huge Kickstarter fundraiser. They raised $116,000 in the month of March. Tamara Sharp and Corey Dorrance have got everyone moved over to the Marshall 12 building that they're going to be doing a lot of changes to. I've had the privilege of speaking with Tamara, and they're super excited to get started. Right now, they are doing a live online auction of everything that's left in the theater that they were not able to move with them. Patty Miller, their costumer, has packed everything up, and they had a great crew move them over. So they are officially in the Marshall 12 building. They're hoping to open their new theater season early November of this year. They will be performing at Rice Lake High School between now and then.
Well, getting back to your theatrical experience, do you like directing better, or do you like acting better?
No, I don't act.
Oh, you don't act.
I think if you can't act, you direct. Oh. So my gifts are in administration and making sure everything is there on time so that when our cast come in, they have what they need, and just making sure that they feel well taken care of. So that's my gift. My husband's gift is really acting and having the ability for the blocking. So I do a lot of the pre-work, get us all ready, set up, and I do all the set design as far as bringing in all of the pieces that need to be there so it all fits. Steven takes over as soon as the cast is on the floor and they start production, and then he does all of the blocking and ensuring that lines are coming off in the way that he feels would be best. We do a lot of natural directing where we sit back and allow the cast to go ahead and run through the scenes and see what they find. We may ask them to try it a different way, but ultimately it's however the cast believes it's done best and what they're most comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Well, the play is Church Basement Ladies. It's the season's final production of the Barron Spotlighters, and it'll run Friday through Sunday and the following Friday through Sunday in the Barron Area Community Center.
And Fridays and Saturdays are at 7:30. Sundays are at 2:30. There are over 500 tickets that have already been sold, so please call Barron Spotlighters to reserve your tickets, or you can come to the window an hour before the show starts to get your ticket.
Buffy Mitchell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Jim.
Next, everything you need to know about the Eau Claire Jazz Festival. But Jim Oliver has places to go and people to see. And before he exits the premises, here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin.
Thank you, sir. The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will present Lone Star Spirits Friday through April the 29th in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater. The big uncut flick episode 2 will be staged by a new theater company, Performance Anxiety Inc., through Saturday at the Grand Theater in Eau Claire. Don't Hug Me, We're Family will run Fridays and Saturdays at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will run through May 19th. The Clear Lake Community Theater will present The Addams Family Friday through Sunday in the Clear Lake Community Center. And the musical Big Fish will be presented by the University of Wisconsin Stout Theater through Saturday in the Harvey Hall Theater at the University in Menominee. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
Time again for the big Eau Claire Jazz Festival. That's one of the headliners, Bob Mintzer, coming to one of America's oldest and most prestigious gatherings of jazzers, young and old. We're just about a week away, and Eau Claire Jazz, Inc. past president Mark Blaski paid us a visit to chat about the 52nd annual. The release that I read listed those who will be participating in this year's event as professional performers, educators, students, connoisseurs, and dabblers. From that list, it's pretty clear into which category I fit. I am a dabbler.
I am a dabbler.
Are you?
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
I love watching this art form develop. I can't do it myself, so I suppose that makes us dabblers.
But you're kind of a connoisseur, too. You take in a lot of music.
I do.
You travel to see jazz.
Yes.
I'm a dabbler, you're a dabbler. Pretty neat that the anniversary and the Friday night both sport the same number this year. 52nd Street, 52nd anniversary.
I hadn't put that together. Nicely done.
This blows the next question, because I was going to say, are there special things planned because of that happenstance? But I guess not.
And not because of the coincidence of 52 and 52nd Street, but we do have a lot of special things planned.
It's already special.
It's already special.
That's my point. There's a very strong trio of objectives in the Jazz Festival every year. Entertainment, education, and inspiration. Now, high school and college bands travel from afar, far and wide, to participate and compete. Do you maintain a comfortable number of entrants, or how do you handle growth, or is there growth?
Oh, there is growth. We are handling it by the size of facilities we have. Fortunately, Centennial Hall opened on campus here 2 or 3 years ago, gave us a lot more space to have bands play and adjudicate. So that was a limitation, but it isn't now. We're up to 130, 140 bands, last I heard, which will be a record for us because we now have the room, and we get the adjudicators to handle all those.
But that can't be really unlimited. You can't just keep growing and growing and growing. There has to be a saturation point.
There's a difficulty. You want the same adjudicators for the same class. So
sure.
You can't have two different sets of adjudicators for class AA because the results wouldn't jive. So there's a time and fit. But we have a lot of non-competitive bands coming in now who get adjudicated but not scored. So they get feedback from the adjudicators but aren't ranked. And that's a real popular category.
Any idea where the furthest one is coming from?
Last year we had a band come from Montana. We've had them come from North Carolina, of course, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin.
They play music in Montana? Oh, no, they just ride horses there. Can you tell I've never been to Montana? And I'm sorry for any Montanans that are out there. Okay, let's start with Friday and Friday evening. New venues along Barstow Street?
We have a total of 18 venues now, up two from last year. The new ones are actually south of Lake Street, the Metro.
Oh, sure.
Okay. And next door, the brand new coffee shop, Shift.
Hmm.
We just added them about a week or two ago. And the Metro, of course, used to be the Mandarin Club.
Yes.
And that was a hopping place in the mid-late 80s. From there all the way north to the Lakely and the local store. So we're off of Barstow Street a little bit, and we are branching out. So we have 18 venues now and 57 bands playing from 5 o'clock in the afternoon until 2 a.m.
So it's not just 52nd Street. There's other streets now.
There are other streets now. And
you may have to come up with a new thing.
Well, we like the kid that 52nd Street in Manhattan has now been renamed Barstow Street.
Oh, sure.
Because we took 52nd from them.
Why not?
But we have a variety of bands. So
that's
if you don't
crazy.
Like what you're listening to, go next door to the Mousetrap or Clancy's or...
I'd get two or three in. I can only drink so much beer. And you walk into a place, you feel a little guilty saying, you know, I'm at the water stage now. Do you mind? Is there a cover charge in
there? There is a wristband. You
oh,
buy
this
a wristband.
For the whole deal, yes.
For the whole Friday night up and down Barstow Street.
Sure, sure.
And there are separate ticket booths out on the street where you buy them, and then you're just unlimited access all night long.
The way spring has been going, you have to have your fingers crossed.
I've been checking the extended. And
there have been some years when it was balmy.
It was. The first year it snowed 7 inches that Friday morning, and most of it melted. But the next year it was 75 degrees. So we've been all over the board, and this year...
You just don't want to have to wear a winter jacket and go... Okay, so Friday night and Saturday night there are headliner concerts. Who's the headliner Friday night? Because I have some of their music. I have music from each guy.
We have two headliners, an L.A.-based musician named Bob Mincer, a saxophone player. He's been in all kinds of bands for many years, and he's a composer and arranger. And then we're bringing back another headliner from a few years ago, a man named Bobby Sanabria from New York City, who's a Latin music-based percussionist, and he drives a mean band. Al, I think you may have seen him last time he was here. Mm-hmm. It was at Memorial High School. About three-quarters of the way through his set, there were impromptu conga lines forming up and down the aisles of Memorial High School, including the then-chancellor was in one of the conga lines. Bobby can drive a band, and you cannot stop moving.
I went online and watched some of his YouTube videos. A little bit of energy.
What I liked, especially in addition to the energy, he keeps a list on his music stand of all the musicians he's playing with, for example, Jazz One.
Ah, cool.
And he knows, he may not know them, but he knows that the first alto just played a solo, and he will call out their names after the tune's over. So he's very connected that way. Yeah.
That's Mark Blaski, and we're talking about the 52nd Eau Claire Jazz Festival. It is April 20th and 21st. That's a Friday. And a Saturday, with a lot of people I've talked to who perform at the State Theater, it's kind of a bittersweet year. Goodbye, State Theater. How does the Pablo Center at the Confluence fit into plans for the Jazz Festival?
Well, with the two theaters, of course, the Royal Credit Union Theater will be around 1,200 seating, right, and then the smaller Black Box around 400. That gives us some flexibility to have some events going on at the same time.
Cool.
Plus, we'll also be able to do some adjudicating in there and maybe some concerts in the lobby, some other informal things.
Wow.
We have a long way to go on our plans on that, but it gives us, and obviously, world-class acoustics and a tunable room or two and great sight lines. One of the things that we always lament at the State Theater, you can't see very well unless you're in a balcony.
Sure.
But here you're pitched up so high you'll be able to see everybody on stage. And there's a lot of backstage room and places for people to warm up. And
so in other words, the Pablo Center fits very well.
Totally, very well.
Festival.
Yes.
And I'm sure the first year it'll take the spotlight. This is going to be the jewel, but there's lots of stuff going on elsewhere in all different places, including the university campus.
And a couple of people we're looking at for the Pablo Center. Big brand name artists. By and large, you bring in a jazz artist, most of us don't know who that person is. I'm even guilty of that, even though I've been around here for quite a while. We always rely on Bob Baca's expertise, and he never fails. He always brings in great artists. But now we're trying to bring in the artists who maybe cross over into the pop genre a little bit, or jazz and pop, and it's names you might recognize. We're going to take a bit of a leap.
Oh, but I can tell the cat's still in the bag.
We're talking.
Hopefully, yes. I will be part of the scoop.
Yes.
So now, people like me, the dabblers, or I like this word better. I looked it up. I'm a dilettante. By the way, if you don't know what a dilettante is, it can have an E or not at the end of it. People with an amateur interest in the arts, not necessarily the connoisseur. We can, this is back to the daytime events, we can attend the daytime jazz festival events like competition performances, clinics, master classes.
Absolutely. It's all over campus.
That's cool.
Haas Centennial. Davies, you could walk in, walk out anytime. And exactly right, Al. You can see these master classes, both Bob Mincer and Bobby Sanabria, late in the afternoons, Friday and Saturday. We'll talk in Schofield and take questions and answers from the crowd. Those are very well done. And it's also fun. A story I like to tell is watching the adjudicators work. It's not so much judging as teaching. These are generally professional musicians or professional and teachers both, and they'll have a band perform their two or three tunes, and then often they'll get up out of their chairs in the back room and walk up and work with the trumpet player or the drummer and say, play this a little bit differently and maybe just step up and redirect half the piece again, and you can see the improvement or hear the improvement in the band already from these skilled adjudicators. So absolutely, we highly encourage coming onto campus. Parking's available behind Davies, free on Saturdays, and just come meander around.
So if you do those daily things, competitions and clinics and stuff, then the evening performance is just a natural progression. Your day can start and just keep going up and up and up and up. The evening performance then would be a culmination, kind of a zenith.
Mm-hmm. And both Friday night and Saturday night performances are a little bit different. We take some of the winning bands from earlier in the day, and they perform. UWEC Jazz One then performs with both of the headliners. And then, sure, this will happen. At the end, it's a big jam where both headliners and UWEC band come out and play the conga lines out the door.
I may go this year again. Now, we've covered a lot of stuff, but if we want more, there's a good website.
EauClaireJazz.com.
in an easy website.
Tells you everything you need to know. Oh, one thing that we're developing, and I don't have a link to this right now, is we have an app for the festival. So you download this app, like all the big festivals, and it tells you all the schedules, all the headliners, all the bios of the adjudicators. If you're in a band, it tells you where you're supposed to be to either play on 52nd Street or what room you're supposed to play in if you're Winona High School. So that's going live, obviously, before the festival, but any day. We've made an investment in this app, and it's per the feedback we got from participants.
You guys are getting big time.
Well, you know, all the big festivals have it. We're trying
and
to get
you're
big.
That.
Downtown Eau Claire's largest music festival.
52nd annual this year. 52nd Street. See a link there, folks?
It's a magic number.
Yeah. Mark, thanks.
Thank you, Al.
I don't know. Did somebody say conga line? ...52 years of jazz music and doing the stuff that assures its continuation, mentoring young people, showing them how it's done at the highest level, and maybe paving roads that lead there eventually. The Eau Claire Jazz Festival, very cool and very important. Hey, let's talk with Ashley Parker of the Washington Post next on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, where an average of 97% of graduates go on to employment, further schooling, or volunteer service within 8 months. Information at luther.edu. The 21st annual DeVroy Memorial Forum is named after Anne DeVroy, Wisconsin native, UW Eau Claire graduate, and eventual White House reporter for the Washington Post, who died too young in 1997, but whose legacy is alive both here and at the Post. How fitting that a member of a new generation of post-White House reporters should come to Eau Claire and speak at the assembly honoring her legacy. Ashley Parker writes for The Post, is a regular panelist on MSNBC, NBC News, The NewsHour, and Washington Week on PBS, and more. She'll deliver her address next Thursday, the 19th, and took time prior to a White House briefing a couple days ago to talk on the phone. I like to get an idea, Ashley, of what makes people tick and how the engine got started. So was young Ashley a reporter on her high school and college newspapers? Did she love English classes? How did your fire ignite?
Yeah, guilty on all fronts. Okay. I wrote for my high school paper and edited for my high school paper. I wrote for my college paper and edited for my college paper. And I always like English.
Was it at that time that you decided that this was going to be what you were doing?
The truth is, I always loved, I know you're never supposed to say this to editors, allegedly, but I always loved writing. And I sort of feel like journalism is poor man's writing, right? If I had any good plots, I think I would be just as happy being like a novelist. Or if I was like particularly lyrical, I think being a poet would have been cool. But sort of, you know, journalism involves writing, and then you don't have to come up with the stories on your own. And in fact, you are advised not to.
Sure. Well, I don't think you should talk past tense when you talk all those possibilities, because there's lots of time.
True.
So you've represented and are representing a couple of America's most iconic big city newspapers, the New York Times, now the Post. Was it a fast road to these media mountaintops, or did you pay some dues in a small newsroom or two?
Well, so the answer is sort of both, in that my first job out of college was at the New York Times, but I started as a research assistant for Maureen Dowd. You know, and Maureen, I should say, was a wonderful boss and is still a wonderful mentor, but I think anytime you're sort of an assistant, there's an element of dues paying.
Yeah,
but
okay.
So I did start at the Times, but in a dues paying role.
Good. Well, I just wanted to make sure you did pay dues, because we don't take people on this show who haven't paid dues. Now, your most recent places of employment are famous homes of the most fake of fake news, according to some presidential pundits. A somewhat undisciplined One, of course, the pundit I'm talking about with unruly hair, recently called the Washington Post a lobbyist organization. How do reporters handle getting handles like that? And how do you maintain objectivity in the face of ridicule, I guess, for lack of a better word?
Sure. So first I should say, and just sort of echo what our executive editor and our publisher have said, which is there's no truth to the president's statements that we are somehow a lobbying arm or, frankly, in any way of Amazon or in any way affiliated with Amazon. We are totally independent from Amazon. We are owned by Jeff Bezos, who is the founder of Amazon, and that seems to be what the president is sort of seizing on. But that is the end of the connection, and we have complete editorial independence. That said, you know, I think different news outlets respond to attacks on them in the media differently, but at the Post, we're pretty clear about how we handle it, which is that we don't respond. It doesn't change anything we do, and we think the best response is to continue to do our jobs and let our reporting speak for itself. And I will say, when you are in an environment where you're getting called fake news, I think, you know, at the Post and at the Times, we always strive to be 100% accurate and 100% fair and add context and value for our readers. And it maybe just makes you understand how important that accuracy is, right? Because you don't want to give anyone, or and that fairness, you don't want to give anyone an excuse to call you fake news. So if previously I triple-checked sort of all of my facts and details, maybe now in this environment I quadruple-check them. We don't respond and don't really think about it that much.
It's the voice of Ashley Parker, Washington Post White House reporter, MSNBC contributor, PBS The NewsHour, Washington Week as well. She's appearing Thursday, April 19th, 7 p.m. at the 21st Annual DeVroy Memorial Forum at UW-Eau Claire. And the theme of that talk is Covering Washington in the Age of Trump. Ashley, touching on the theme of next week's Wisconsin appearance, is there a basic difference or one easily explained between just covering Washington and covering Washington in the age of Trump?
Yes and no. I may not be the best person to speak to that in the sense that this is the first White House I've covered. Okay. And again, I know at the Post we don't cover this White House any differently than we cover any other White Houses. But I will say this White House presents sort of different challenges. Every White House presents a different character, a different tone, a different set of players and characters and challenges, and this one is no exception. And one of those is just the sort of fire hose of constant news. You did not have presidents previously who woke up and at 6:37 a.m. began making major news on Twitter. So, you know, having reporters who are awake and sitting in front of, on our White House team, who are awake and sitting in front of their laptops at that hour, I think is something that exists now that didn't exist before, although it certainly would have if that was President Obama's preferred style of communicating.
Sure. I read that you cover a lot of Republican people and topics. Is that an assignment? Is that a choice? How does that happen?
It's mainly been an assignment, sort of just dictated by the political landscape, but I have to say I like it, and some of it feeds on itself. The first presidential campaign I covered was Mitt Romney in 2012, and that was just because that was the open campaign to cover, right? If you were going to be covering a campaign in 2012, you were going to be covering a Republican. And I covered Romney, and I loved it. I loved covering presidential campaigns, and I also got really well-sourced, you know, with a number of people in that world. And I could have just as easily gotten a Democratic assignment, but I do think then I had some Republican sources. So in 2016, when I was first assigned to Jeb Bush and then to President Trump, it was nice that some of the people I got to know that first go-around were then, you know, the sources I'd now known instead of just for a year, for 5 years.
I was having a conversation with some folks last week about the things that you guys do and the environment in which you're doing it in Washington now. The discussion came up about reporters and sources. Do reporters compare notes, or are you ultra-protective of more things than just sources?
In what sense? Well, I'll say with members of my own team at the Washington Post, and again, it sort of depends on the situation, it depends on the sensitivity, and it depends on the source, but we work very well together and are pretty transparent and collegial. But that's not to say that everyone knows everything in every moment, right?
Yeah, the only reason I ask that is it seems so often that reporters are getting credit for breaking a story. And so that leads one to say, gee, I wonder how protective they are of the ingredients of that story.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at a lot of stories at the Post, for instance, sometimes scoops, you know, or good details come from just one person, but more often than not, at the Post and frankly at other places, there's two people on the byline or three people on the byline. And so I think once you're operating in an environment where you realize the reason we're able to have these great scoops or to write these stories that have good details is because it's sort of two people coming together, three people coming together with a lot of teamwork. It just creates a pretty collegial atmosphere, which again is not to say that everyone knows everyone's source, and we're very careful about source protection. But no one is sort of protective or turfy in a way, because those stories are the product of a bunch of different people and a bunch of different people's insight and information and reporting and writing skills.
Obviously, you have insights into the role of female reporter in today's political environment. Have you seen it evolve, yours and women's in general on the reporting side?
That's a great question. I do not think it has. I can only speak for myself personally, but I do not think it has necessarily evolved as much as one might hope or expect. And by that, I mean, for instance, I get a lot of negative email and Twitter comments. So do my male colleagues. I think the sort of tone and tenor and content of the missives that female reporters get are often more gendered and more sexual in nature than male reporters is one example, which is not to say that, you know, some people don't just purely disagree with me and don't make a crude sexual comment, but but there's a lot of that. And it's not to say that my male colleagues don't get any sort of appearance-based content or, again, crude sexual content, but I don't think to the same level.
I watched the White House briefings live. What is the ratio female to male in a crowd like that?
Oh, of reporters?
Yeah.
On that level, actually, I'm trying to think. I actually think a lot of the full-time reporters covering Trump, at least on the campaign, were female. I think it felt more heavily female, actually.
That's what I thought, Tayshia.
And certainly the reporters who the president called out a lot by name, and there were certainly male television reporters he called out, but he definitely called out a lot of the female television reporters, and that seemed to get a lot more attention.
Yeah. A couple more questions. This one back to the basics of being a reporter. What kind of, this is my curiosity speaking, what kind of aspirations do reporters have? Is it the breaking big story that I brought up previously? Is it achieving the rank of columnist? I mean, you're already on a big stage. Is there a next natural professional step that reporters dream of? And I promise I won't tell your current employer.
The truth is, I think it totally depends on the reporter. I will say, having my first job that I mentioned, having worked for a columnist, I know just how difficult those columns are. When you read a great column, it looks like Maureen Dowd or Ruth Marcus just woke up and had a fascinating, interesting thought and dashed it off in a really engaging way. And there's a lot more work that goes into it than that. So I don't know that my end goal is to be a columnist. but, you know, I think there's reporters who are obsessed, and rightfully so, with scoops. And they just want the next big story and the next big scoop and the next great detail. There's reporters who are great investigative reporters, and their goal is to have a beat that allows them to do a deep dive into documents for 3 months and then come up and write a huge blockbuster. There's reporters who love narrative long-form journalism, and, you know, their end goal would be to write for a magazine, you know, and have a month or 6 weeks to write 8,000 words, 12,000 words. So I think it totally depends. I like the narrative long form, and I also sort of like the exhilaration of scoops and breaking news.
It would be too long of an answer for me to ask what a typical day is like, but I think our audience would be curious as to what it's like to be a reporter at the Washington Post. So let me phrase it this way. What do you do the first thing you come into your office in the morning? What's the first thing you want to do? besides getting a cup of coffee, I would guess.
Yes. Well, so one thing that I think, again, to your previous question, that is a little new is I think the first thing every White House reporter does when they wake up is they roll over and they check their phone and they see if the president has tweeted and made news. But I think other than that, some days where you're coming into your office and you're getting ready to sit in the chair to the briefing to ask questions of Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Other days you're coming in and you're trying to figure out what is the president going to do on Syria? What is his response going to be? And so you're making a bunch of calls, sending a bunch of emails, sending a bunch of texts, trying to get people to get back to you. Sometimes you're doing that and then racing off to meet someone in person.
Sure. So there's the appeal. I mean, no day is the same as the previous.
Yeah, exactly.
Good for you. Ashley Parker, thanks, and keep up what I and many others consider very good work. Travel safely, and we look forward to seeing you in Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Ashley Parker, White House reporter for The Washington Post, speaks at UW Eau Claire's Schofield Auditorium next Thursday, April 19th, 7 p.m. The DeVroy Memorial Forum is free and open to you and I. We're known as the public, yes. Let's shoot out some Spectrum memos for you. The Heidi Center for the Arts welcomes Jig Jam, the award-winning music quartet from Ireland, Friday evening. Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts welcomes Lane Yost, who does a tribute to the music of John Denver. That is Saturday. The Dunn County Barbershoppers present the 49th Annual Harmony Show this year, Hillbilly Harmony, Saturday evening in the Martin Anderson Gymnasium in Colfax. The Eau Claire Male Chorus Spring Sing and Dinner Concerts will be Friday evening in the Eau Claire Regis High School Auditorium, Saturday evening in the Masonic Ballroom on Graham Avenue in downtown Eau Claire. Reservations are required for the dinner concert. 715-835-7369 is that phone number if you want to reserve for the dinner concert. It's 835-7369. And there's going to be a reading and book signing for the book featured here a while back on Spectrum West called Life Upon the Wicked Stage, Will Denson. That'll be next Wednesday evening, April 18th, Community Room, Altoona Public Library. That starts at 7. Thank you, Hannah, for promotional pros, Kate for schedules and archives, and Dean for everything else. We're cooking up another Spectrum stew for next week and hope you'll be able to dine with us. Till then, for Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross with thanks for stopping by.